Okay, we get underway here. Hi, good afternoon. My name is Blair Watson from Vancouver, Canada. Yeah, this is my sixth conference. First one I attended was in 1998 in Las Vegas, and it certainly has grown quite a bit since then. And of course, the impact or the internet has had just an enormous impact on Mormonism. And as Simon was indicating in his address, that it already has had profound effects on the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. There's a podcast interview with Grant Palmer, LDS author, CES director, on the MormonStories.org website, which is, it's a pro-LDS website. It's fascinating to listen to his interview. It's broken out into four episodes. I listened just to episode four. And in that, he says that he has it on very good authority from, I guess, a fairly well-placed source within the church office building, that about 100,000 people a year are formally resigning from the church. And that Greg Dodge has had to double his staff just to process the requests for resignations and the excommunications. So that gives you an idea of just the magnitude of what's happening. And if you go to the MormonStories.org website, it's in the May 2006 link on the right side. And very interesting because, of course, what the church did to him in terms of disfellowshipping him, they had absolutely no grounds to do so. The man simply presented historical information, just like, you know, Simon and Tom Murphy presented scientific information. And that will come into my presentation about why there is this problem for Latter-day Saints, for a lot of Latter-day Saints, in trying to reconcile, of course, their religious faith, what they've been taught for, in some cases, for decades, with the information that is out there. My own experience, I was raised in Mormonism. My mother joined in the mid-60s. I was just a toddler. She absolutely felt the church was true, felt that it was her responsibility to raise her kids, of course, in the church. My father is an atheist, and so some major power struggles in their marriage. I was the only male, and so a bit of a pawn on the chessboard between the two of them over the course of their marriage for the time that they stayed together. And I remember distinctly sitting in primary and Sunday school, 7, 8 years old, 9 and older, and just having this really strong, raw, undefined sense that there was something really wrong with the world of Mormonism as I was experiencing it. The problem was, for me as a young person, of course, that I was being taught that the church was perfect. It was the one true church of Jesus Christ. It had been, you know, revealed by God, all of the ordinances and the priesthood and the teachings and everything else. So how could I possibly, as a 7, 8, 9-year-old, be correct in my gut-level feeling that there was something really wrong with the church, the religion, and Latter-day Saints in general, when there were millions of people who fervently believed that Mormonism was true, that the senior leaders of the church were the most spiritually enlightened men on the planet, that the president of the church received revelations directly from the Lord and on occasion spoke with Jesus Christ in the temple, that these men at the top of the church's patriarchal structure were prophets, seers, and revelators. And so that created a great deal of confusion for me. And then once I got into my teens, then the guilt started because, of course, I was going through entering adolescence puberty, and we were handed the for young men only little booklet, if you remember that, with the all American looking boys on the front. If you remember back in the days when there was like no ugly people in the Ensign, none whatsoever. You know, they blondes with the fluffy puffy hair and the really good looking men with the cleft chins and everything else. That was another aspect of Mormonism. You know, it was about the appearance, of course. Appearances meant more than just the substance. So moving through my teen years, in my head, I just had this growing sense that there was a pressure cooker building. And after I left the church in my late 20s, and I talked with psychologists about what I was experiencing, they said basically you were heading for a psychic breakdown. Psychic in the sense of the psyche. And what happened was, so through my teen years, served a mission for the church in Peru. And they had sent me to a country that was embroiled in very serious problems. Terrorism, a very large terrorism movement, Sendero Luminoso, had killed tens of thousands of Peruvians. The country was basically going down the toilet really fast. And here I was as a naive 19-year-old being sent to a shanty town on the outskirts of Lima to proselytize and to convert people. And 10 days into the mission, I came down with spinal meningitis, which will kill in about 24 to 48 hours. And fortunately, there was a sister missionary from Idaho who had been a registered nurse, and she saved my life. She was the one who recognized what was going on. The assistants to the president had just dumped me in the bottom of bunk and basically had left me there. And what I found out at the end of my mission was that in that experience, the mission president had been intercepted at the airport coming back from a zone conference, and he was taken directly to the mission home, or to the clinic, the small clinic where I was, and he lied to me. He told me that I had typhoid fever, and the pieces of the puzzle never fell into place for me until like a couple of years ago when I was thinking about that experience. Why would this man lie to me about having the fact that in truth, I had this very serious disease? And it was because in my first interview, for those of you who have been on missions, when you get into the mission home, there's the orientation you go through and you have your first interview with the mission president. And my mission president asked me, well, what did your father and mother do? My mother's a nurse. And he must have figured that if I had been told the truth about having spinal meningitis, which takes a good 6 to 12 months to fully recuperate, that I would have told my mother, who would have insisted on me being sent home, and for perhaps numbers reasons, I was to stay. He had decided unilaterally that I was to stay in the mission field. And I was very sick for all throughout pretty much the rest of my mission. I came home loaded with parasites, 35 pounds lighter than you see me now, basically on death's door. And it took me a hell of a long time to clean all that up. By the end of the mission, I was psychologically, the psychic pressure was building. I had spent most of my formative years in southern Ontario, so not a large Mormon population there. There was maybe, I think, about four of us in the high school, my local high school. My father, of course, as I mentioned, didn't join the church, was an atheist. And what I sensed from childhood moving through my adolescence into my young adult years was that non-Mormons just generally seemed to be a lot happier than Latter-day Saints. They were a lot more comfortable with themselves in high school. I really felt that. And that was right across the spectrum from the preppies to the guys who were wearing the AC/DC t-shirts and carrying a pack of Demoriers under their cigarettes under their sleeves. So that didn't make any sense to me. I mean, how could it be that the chosen people of God were perceivably less happy than people who didn't have the truth? So that only added to my confusion. In my mind on an upper level, I felt kind of stupid. But at a deeper level, I actually sensed that I was fairly intelligent. So this jumble of these intuitive feelings, senses, Mormon indoctrination, so ideas that had been programmed into my mind, just like you would, in a sense, like you would program a computer. It had all gone in over 18 plus years, and I was heading for a breakdown. And that happened through the course of my college. I did a 3-year professional pilot training program, and graduated, and thank goodness that my first job out of college was flying in parts of Canada where the LDS Church is not, like the Arctic, and working with a bunch of guys who were just, you know, beer drinking, down to earth, hardworking, fun, great guys. And another reality that had come into my sphere of knowledge was some of these guys were, you know, sexually active when they're on the road. But our manager, for example, had when he was in the Royal Canadian Air Force, had pulled a pilot from a burning aircraft, an aircraft that was on the verge of exploding. Now, when I was a Mormon, I was taught that no greater love, you know, does a person have than if they lay their life on the line and sacrifice the thing that is most precious, their life, for someone else. And here is this guy who, you know, was a fornicator. And he had done exactly that. Now in LDS doctrine, he should be going to the highest level of the celestial kingdom, but he's a fornicator, so he's going to the celestial kingdom. So that just, it didn't make any sense. So, you know, more of the confusion. And then in the early 90s, one weekend I happened to stop by the local ward and attended the ward picnic. And I met a young man there who had just come in from the Canadian Maritimes. And to make a very long story short, what happened to this young man who has cerebral palsy, he's now in his early 30s, is that when he was 12 years old, he was sexually abused and physically assaulted by a 24-year-old Mormon missionary. And he had confided in a local member, a woman, the two of them had told the mission president, who had very quickly transferred the elder out of the area but allowed him to continue and finish his mission. They told two bishops, and basically told him to forget about it. And because of his cerebral palsy, he wasn't able to verbally communicate what happened to him. And it came out in just little, in bits and pieces. I spent a year and a half going over to his place with my notepad taking notes. And I wrote a report for the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, who investigated it. And the case is open. And U.S. authorities have been contacted and they're trying to track down, this individual. But what happened at an even higher level was that this mission president returned to Salt Lake City and later became a general authority. And what happened to me is an extraordinary experience. We talk about when the first crack happens. I was flying aerial survey. We were based in Smithers, BC, small community in northern BC, and we finished flying for the day. And I just went into the local library, a couple of rooms really, just with some books, flipping through the rack of paperbacks, and there was the Mormon Murders. I had never heard of the book, was intrigued by the title, signed it out, and started reading it. And for those of you who have read that book, yeah, it's talking, of course, about the whole Hoffman affair and Hoffman's relationships with Hinckley and other senior church leaders, and how he duped them, of course, to buy his forged documents. And where was the power of discernment, of course, that these men are supposed to have? So that was another fact that was tipping the seesaw in the direction of I don't believe in Mormonism anymore. But most extraordinarily for me is what had never made sense for me after interviewing this young man doing the report for the RCMP is how could this mission president be elevated to the ranks of general authority when this crime had been committed, he had not done his job. Police hadn't been contacted. There hadn't been a proper investigation. Just a common sense approach would be to do a proper investigation and to involve authorities, and at least find out whether there's enough evidence to support this young man's allegations or not. So that injustice was outstanding. And it didn't make any sense to me how in the true church that is based on revelation and men are called to positions of authority and trust and responsibility, that this injustice could have carried on and not been resolved before this individual was established in the ranks as a general authority. And then in the book, The Mormon Murders, the answer was there. And it was, he was an individual who was willing to put up quietly enough money to buy the McClellan collection for the church and quietly donate it to the church, where it would never see the light of day. And so the huge penny dropped for me. He was willing to scratch the church's back, so to speak, in a time of great need and a delicate matter. And of course he had the connections, and so the church rewarded him for doing that. And so I flew back to Ontario and terminated my membership in the church. Just ethically, morally, in every respect, I could not support this organization that had so clearly not done its duty on behalf of one of its members, and that began a process for me. Obviously, I'd been psychologically inching my way out of Mormonism for a number of years, but there was this psychic pressure in my mind that I was just had been building for so many years, and I had to deal with it. And I had quite a severe health crisis at the time, and I'm very grateful that I did, because it forced me. I spent a year addressing those health problems, and during that year, I did a lot of research into how Mormonism affects people psychologically. I went on the internet actually wasn't, this is the early 90s, right? So the internet hadn't gone widespread, sort of gone worldwide in the sense of being easily accessible to people. I just couldn't find any information. There was information about cults and the psychodynamics of cults, how cults psychologically affect people, and there are those characteristics of cults and cultic groups that apply to Mormonism and the LDS Church. But I needed to know for myself the specifics. How did Mormonism cause this psychic pain in my mind? What had it done to my mind from a very, very early age? And how was I going to get over it? And so that has been sort of my quest for the last 14 years. And I've done a lot of research and attended conferences and spoken with psychologists, and so the information that I'm going to present to you is sort of a summary, basically, of main points of what I've learned over the last 14 years. Okay, how Mormonism wounds self-esteem and what we can do about it. Okay, before I get into what self-esteem is, it's just to create a common foundation of knowledge, I want to talk about what we are fundamentally, and that is awareness. When you were born, metaphorically speaking, this was you. You had no concept of self. You had no conscious thought. You had no external information from your physical environment. Right from the time that you were born, and well, they know, of course, for in utero, of course, a fetus, a developing fetus is picking up the physical sensations that is coming through the mother. But in psychological terms, this is you. You are a blank slate, and psychologists, psychiatrists know that for about the first 6 months of life, children don't have, infants don't have a concept of self. So when a one-month-old baby is looking up into mommy or daddy's face, they are not psychologically differentiating between them and that person that they are looking at. They are psychologically fused with everything and everyone around them. And through this very organic evolutionary process, during approximately the first 6 months of your life, of our lives, as we were being fed and pooping and interacting with family members and experiencing our physical environment, we started to develop psychologically on a very rudimentary level. But what are we fundamentally? We are a unit of awareness that exists in a physical interface system, our body. Awareness is not mind. Awareness is more fundamental than mind. It is more primordial than mind. Because when you think a thought, something is doing the thinking. You are aware of your thoughts. You're aware of physical sensations, your emotions, needs, wants, impulses, intuition, instincts, dreams, behavior. And so as you go through your life, you are engaged in the act of being aware on multiple levels, if you will. So, how that relates and how that relates to self-esteem is, as we were going through our infancy and into our early childhood, people started writing on us, so to speak. Whatever family situation we were born into, people were sending us messages, our parents or parent or whoever raised us, whoever had the primary responsibility to take care of us, whoever interacted with us. There were messages, dozens, hundreds of messages every day that we were receiving because we are fundamentally a unit of awareness. So the verbal, the nonverbal, and we just learned to cope as best we could in whatever environment we were raised in. So if that was sort of the standard nuclear family with happy, emotionally well-adjusted parents, and all of our physical needs were taken care of, and we had fun siblings to play with, and it was a great environment, then we probably had a happy childhood. And if we experienced something else, mistreatment or abuse, neglect to any degree, then we were aware of that. And we were taking that in second by second, minute by minute. And when you think of, for example, when NASA sends these probes out into outer space, they have tens of thousands of lines of code that they have to write so that this probe knows what to do at certain points in its trek as it's moving through the solar system and beyond. And that's what happened to us on this second by second basis. These lines of code were being written into our psyche, essentially. And those lines of code were influenced, were the function of how people were treating us. And of course the nonverbal, communication. So if we did something and mother's face went a certain way, then we quickly learned that if there was a withdrawal of love or approval, if we behaved in that way, then we better not behave that way anymore, or at least not around mother. Because we were there to survive. The survival instinct in children is the most powerful because they are completely dependent on their parent, whoever takes care of them, for their physical survival. And so they will do virtually whatever is necessary to survive because we entered life, of course, completely dependent on someone else taking care of us. And so we went through childhood, learning to cope as best as we can, best as we could. There are eight stages of psychological development. I'm not going to get into them. Wikipedia's actually got a very good summary of those, the different ages and how we needed to develop at those different stages. But really, the point of being a child and moving through your adolescent years is to move from a place of being 100% dependent to being independent, to learning enough skills to take care of your physical survival, to provide for yourself. And what's the objective of going through that approximately 18-year process? It's to be able to go out into the adult world and function as an independent adult. And psychologists, psychiatrists will talk about individuation. That's the process of making yourself an individual, because you started out psychologically fused with absolutely no concept of yourself as a self, and ideally by the time you're approximately 18 years of age, you have a pretty solid sense of yourself, your personality, your interests, what you want to do with your life, and the fact that, you know, there are connections with your emotional connections with your family of origin, but that process of becoming a teenager, of course, and going through your adolescent years is about, you know, individuating yourself from your parents. And so when you see the kids dressed in their gothic black outfits, or, you know, the tattoos, the piercings, whatever, and parents are horrified, they can be rest assured that what's going on psychologically is your kids are just individuating. So they listen to music that's absolute garbage, which of course was the same comment that your parents said to you. But it's just the process of individuation that's going on. That's in ideal circumstances. To increase in awareness, even if it, second point there. To become more aware is to expand the fundamental characteristic of ourself. And I'll tie this in with Mormonism in just a couple of slides. To increase in awareness, even if doing so involves the collapse of a cherished belief system, is ultimately a choice. And I want you to keep that in mind for the discussion a little later on. We can choose to become more aware or not. Either way, there are consequences. So when we find ourselves perhaps in a situation where suddenly we're confronted with a person, maybe someone who's physically large and a big booming voice, and in a split second we feel like we're 5 years old again, and we can feel the shakes in our legs. At that moment, we can either choose to be aware of how we're feeling, what's coming up for us, or we can quickly stomp down that awareness. So on a second-by-second basis, until the moment that we die, we can either choose to increase in awareness or not. All healing and personal growth is rooted in increased awareness. All of it. And that's not just psychological healing. That's physical healing as well, too. Something's going wrong with your body. You feel that something's just not quite right. So off to the doctor you go. Okay. Mormonism. Why don't I get my notes out so I don't have to strain my neck here. Mormonism psychologically conditions people to mentally flee from, trivialize, or condemn facts, truths, or realities that do not support the LDS Church's foundational claims, doctrines, and teachings. And I imagine that all of us have run into that. So we have an LDS family member or a friend. We've been online, we've maybe read Dr. Southerton's research on DNA evidence. We go to the Mormon family member or friend and say, hey, look, you know, there's this paper or this article in the science section of our newspaper, or I just saw this interesting television program on the Discovery Channel, and it's talking about the fact that Native Americans are genetically linked to people who came from Northeast Asia. And what's the reaction? In many cases, it's either ignoring, mentally fleeing from that piece of information, that truth that you've just presented, or a trivialization of it. We don't really know. You know, the scientists, they don't really know all of the facts. Or the condemnation. So if you've ever confronted a Latter-day Saint and their reaction is defensive, you're attacking the church, you're attacking me, you're attacking my people, you're attacking my religion. That is a condemnation of just the information that you're presenting. And it's, of course, it's an emotional defensive reaction. But what's happening psychologically in Mormons' minds, in their psyches, is you are presenting them with faith-shaking information. And if that first domino falls, then all the other dominoes are going to come tumbling down. The house of cards is going to be knocked over. And so for people who are still psychologically enmeshed, embedded in Mormonism, they can't go there in their mind. Yeah. And I imagine that many of us can relate to that in our personal experience during our process of psychologically leaving Mormonism, that perhaps someone presented us with some information, or we saw a website and we just wouldn't go there. Or how many times have you heard Latter-day Saints say, well, so-and-so presented me with a book, maybe one of the Tanner's books, and I just knew it was of Satan. You know, I just couldn't look at it. I would not touch that. I wouldn't even open the front cover, because psychologically, they just can't go there. But what's happening, this is even more fascinating, is I am convinced that every Latter-day Saint, at least those who live in Western society, where we've got television and the general level of scientific knowledge is fairly good, is that they know on a deep level, they sense, they know that there are just things about Mormonism that are not right. And all of those doubts that have popped into their mind over the years, they've taken those doubts and they've put them into a mental closet and closed the door. And after a while, the door of the mental closet is bulging and they've got to, lean their shoulder into it to keep it from bursting open. But that is a process of diminishing one's awareness and betraying one's mind when a person does that. Mormonism psychologically conditions people to betray their rational mind in order to maintain their irrational, nonsensical religious beliefs. Again, has to be done for psychological reasons, and I'll get into that just a little bit later. The cognitive dissonance, and that's a term that we've heard a fair bit this weekend, and you see it on the RFM website, that many Latter-day Saints experience is the uncomfortable tension that comes from holding two conflicting thoughts simultaneously, or in their mind, sort of back to back. So the Book of Mormon is a true record of peoples in the ancient Americas, which is congruent with the Church's teachings, at least historically. That seems to be shifting. But DNA and archaeological evidence does not support it as a true, real history. Okay, on to self-esteem. I'll read this from the screen because I didn't get this one printed off. To what extent does the quality of our self-esteem affect the quality of our lives? Completely, profoundly. Your self-esteem is the foundation of your ability to live efficaciously. It affects the aspects of your life, and this is by no means a complete list. It affects your relationships, your family of origin relationships, your marriage, other relationships, your schooling and your job, your career, your financial situation. Self-esteem affects your civic lives, involvement as citizens. If you have the self-confidence to get involved in the political process in some way, then you're going to do so. You feel passionately, you feel strongly about some particular issue, and you're going to step up to the plate and you're going to do that. But if you don't have the self-esteem, and if you don't have basically the concept in yourself, if you don't trust yourself enough to even get involved, on the periphery, then you're not going to be going there. Self-esteem affects your social life, your recreation, your self-judgments and other thoughts, the mental tapes that we run through our minds. Self-esteem affects our beliefs about what we can accomplish with our lives, our emotions, our sexual lives. So it has, self-esteem truly is the foundation of ourselves as a individual, as a person, as a being. And the degree to which Mormonism affected our self-esteem is a function of our age when we began to be psychologically conditioned by it. I confronted my mother who joined at the age of 29. I went and visited her this past summer and got into a discussion about just the amount of psychological pain that Mormonism had caused me to experience. She couldn't relate to it whatsoever because she had been raised in basically an agnostic family. She had been interested in churches, religions from about age 12, 13. Her mother had allowed her to attend the Anglican church and check out some other churches. So she was able to individuate herself in that regard. She had her own heartfelt desire to go check out other religions, churches, and she was able to honor that wish and go and do that. But of course, in a Latter-day Saint home, if you have a 12, 13-year-old child who says, you know, I'm kind of interested in the Unitarians. What are they about? Or, you know, some other organization. The response is, unless you've got unless there's a fairly liberally minded Latter-day Saint, is you are a member of the one true Church of God. You know, thinking such thoughts is displeasing to your Heavenly Father. How could you possibly turn your back on the sacrifices of your Mormon ancestors? And on and on and on it goes. It's a function of the age. She couldn't relate because, of course, she hadn't been psychologically conditioned by Mormonism from the early age that I had, and I imagine that many of you have. I'd like to ask, how many people here were born into the church? So most of you. How many were introduced to it sort of age 1 to 6? A couple people. 7 to 12? 13 to 20? Certainly interesting. Say in your 20s, 30s, 40s, one person, and older than 40. Okay. So the vast majority, as it sort of may look like, about 3/4, maybe 80%, born into the church. So all those spiritualistic ideas that have been a part of Mormonism from Joseph Smith's day and have been passed on down through the generations, went into psychologically conditioning you. And if you were raised in an LDS family, you were getting that indoctrination not only every Sunday and on primary night and once you got into seminary, but in your LDS home environment, you were getting it on a daily basis. I sat down and tallied up how much formal indoctrination I had gone through from age 3, which is, I think, Sunbeam started age 3, to the end of my 18th year. It was about 5,000 hours of formal, systematic indoctrination in Mormonism. That's like 2.5 years of full-time work. Yeah. So that's, you might want to just think about that in terms of your own experience. Right. So the foundation, it's, you know, we are so fortunate to live in this generation and in this culture. Imagine being born in Saudi Arabia and being raised in the Wahhabi, extreme version of Islam. You just don't have the knowledge that we are so fortunate to have in this society and in this generation, of how, families affect children, of the importance of self-esteem. The foundation of our self-esteem was created in our formative years, particularly in our childhood. People were modeling behavior to us, whatever that behavior was. And we were just on the receiving end as that unit of awareness existing in a physical interface system and trying to figure out how to deal with that, whatever our situation was in our family of origin. Our self-esteem was influenced profoundly by our parents or parent or whoever took care of us. People enter adulthood with self-esteem that is typically as healthy or as impoverished as the extent to which they were loved and respected or neglected and abused during their formative years. And no matter how low or wounded a person's self-esteem is, it can be improved, healed. And as I have done some counseling work with people exiting Mormonism and other authoritarian cultic religions, it amazes me. It just amazes me how the human spirit, that spark that's right at the center, can endure just so much, and yet it can't be totally extinguished. And there just is that aspect of the self that's just that's just clingy and wants to, it's almost like a, it's almost like a force at the core of our being that is pushing us forward. And forward might be, you know, 1 centimeter, and that's all we can handle for today. Or forward might be something much more drastic than that. And that's why the exit from Mormonism process psychologically, because I've talked with, over the last 7-8 years, hundreds of people exiting Mormonism and reading their posts and emails and what have you. And every experience is so unique. And that uniqueness, at whatever point you are in your process, you really need to, I hope you really honor that. And you recognize the, you know, where you've been and what you've had to deal with in order to reach the point where you're at. But the journey's not over. The journey involves legitimate suffering. This is a term that I first came across in a recorded lecture by Dr. M. Scott Peck, who is a U.S. psychiatrist and author of The Road Less Traveled. He passed away, by the way, last year, October last year. But he said that in psychotherapy, people come to a psychologist or a psychiatrist very often because there's been a crisis in their life, a breakdown of a marriage or loss of a job or whatever, and they think that that's their problem and that's all that they need to deal with and address. And that's really stuff that's just right on the surface. And once you start scratching through and addressing that, you get into just in people's lives just so much in terms of unresolved feelings and old wounds that the individual wasn't able to acknowledge because they grew up in an environment like Linda told us this morning about infants not being able to cry. That's just horrific. And yet, you know, those adults in that cultic group are somehow through physical violence are able to psychologically condition an infant not to cry. That just blew me away. So that process of legitimate suffering involves confronting our fears, becoming aware of our repressed anger and non-destructively expressing it. If that's something that, you know, is coming up for you or you have felt, it came up for me hugely. I was stunned at just how powerful the anger was. Because I'm an intense person anyways. And your healing process will be very much a function of your personality. And I had a physician friend of mine tell me, he said, Blair, you need to learn to access your shadow, your dark side, and find a way or ways to non-destructively express it. He was a married man. He had kids, and how he did it is he took his race vehicle and went out to one of the racetracks where he lived, and he would race at just as fast as he possibly could around the track, just putting his life right on the edge, pushing the envelope. That was very much a function of his personality. That was just his way of expressing that aspect of himself. One of the huge problems with Mormonism and its psychological effects is that it conditions, it programs people to split off and repress all aspects of their humanity that are not allowed to exist as a faithful Mormon. And so we've heard about the stake presidents and the bishops who can sexually abuse their daughters on a Saturday night and then be conducting a meeting the next morning. And how is that possible? Through this splitting off and repressing in that case it would be an aspect of their sexuality. And what mental health professionals know is that things that are split off and repressed, and particularly if the repression goes on for a long time, is that it takes a dark there's a darkness that develops essentially around it, a dysfunction, a serious dysfunction. So something that sexuality, sexual expression, sexual exploration, which in a normal healthy individual is an organic process that, you know, happens during adolescence and into your young adulthood and beyond. And it happens organically. But when there are psychological barriers that are put in place that essentially say to the individual, you're not allowed to be sexual. You're not allowed to even think a single sexual thought, because if you do, you will make yourself spiritually impure. And anything that is spiritually impure, filthy, cannot live with Heavenly Father, with Jesus Christ, with your faithful, righteous LDS family members in the highest level of the celestial kingdom. And so you're not allowed to be aware of that aspect of yourself. Because if you were, the ultimate consequence of that is your eternal suffering. That's what the theology is saying to you. And so for reasons of your spiritual survival, you cannot be aware of that aspect of yourself. It cannot exist. But it does exist because you're human. So how can it possibly exist and not exist? You have to split it off and repress it. And mental health professionals, when they work with pedophiles, when they work with rapists, when they work with people who have histories of physical abuse, they're not just dealing with the sinful behavior. Because behavior is just a symptom, you know. It's just a manifestation of something else, something much, much deeper that needs to be addressed. So bear that in mind. And you might want to, you know, if you still feel that Mormonism is negatively affecting yourself, your life, you might want to go home and just start writing out what aspects of my humanity did Mormonism, as I experienced it, as you experienced it in your family of origin, in your situation growing up, because it's going to be unique, as I said before, for all of us. But what were those messages that I received, that you received? What aspects of my humanity were not allowed to exist? Because there's tremendous healing. The healing process, which I'll talk about later, basically boils down to allowing yourself to become aware of those aspects. And for me, this anger, this, because my mother had psychologically controlled me to, you know, I was going to be an apostle at least. the Mormon mother's dream, right, for every son. And I just wasn't allowed to be me. And so there I am in my late 20s, early 30s, and just the childlike rage that came to the surface. And I used to go down to a park close to where I was living. And fortunately, it was a large park. There was a creek running through it. It was pretty isolated. And I just needed to express my anger physically. But there is no way that I was going to do so. You know, fortunately, I'd become intelligent enough, wise enough by that point in my life that I didn't want to lash out at anybody because I didn't want to hurt anybody. I didn't want to destroy property. But I needed to physically express this anger that was just so close to the core of my being. So I used to go down there and find these dead old large logs and branches and pick them up and just smash them against the trees by the edge of the creek. And you'd hear this crack resonating right through the forest. And I would swear that a profanity that would come out of my mouth. I can remember times when I would wake up in the middle of the night. Sometimes I had nightmares, and following the nightmares, there would be this intense anger. And I would take a 9-iron and I would hop the back fence it was a large school field. This is like 2 in the morning. There's nobody there. And I would club the grass to death. I was just so, so angry. Once I was in my grandmother's basement, and again, one of these, you know, just these repressed emotions that came up to the surface. And I turned around and it was my own fault. And I punched her concrete foundation wall. Well, you can guess who lost on that very short-term battle. I broke a bone in my hand. It was my own fault. But I needed to do that. I needed to do that for myself because it was a function of my personality, just the intensity I have. And it's going to be different for every one of us. maybe there's a very sensitive creative person in this audience. Maybe they've been trying to, you know, keep that lid on that, on grief that they have felt for so many years. And if that's the case, if you sense that about yourself, you need to visit that reservoir of grief as often as it takes to empty it. Think of the number of times where you sat through a fast and testimony meeting and someone would get up to the podium and begin their testimony and then the waterworks would start. I used to be one of those people. I could not bear my testimony without just blubbering, just crying hard. And after I left the church, I thought, I was thinking about that. Why would that be a reality for me? And by the way, members would always come up to me afterwards and say, that was such a spiritual testimony. That was such a lovely test. I felt the Spirit so strongly. And yet I just feel like crap. I'm embarrassed. And what I determined, at least for myself, was, you know, when you're up there, you're in front of people, you're making yourself vulnerable. You're talking about your feelings about the church, about, you know, things that have been going on in your life. And so this emotion starts coming up to the surface. But if there's mixed in with this emotion a huge amount of grief that you've never been allowed to acknowledge, then it's going to be there as well, and it's going to manifest itself. And that's, so I, what I needed to do for myself is I needed to grieve, and I spent a long time grieving for, you know, pain and losses. And any psychotherapist will, you know, you get into, if you ever do psychotherapy, you're going to get into that kind of stuff. It's feeling and working through the emotional and psychological pain resulting from abuse, for example. It's all part of this legitimate suffering because you have to deal with it. Sooner or later, you have to deal with it because it's going to be impacting your personal life, your relationships, maybe your situation at work, just so many aspects of your life. And the reason why people avoid their legitimate suffering work, if you will, is because they sense at some level of awareness that there is going to be pain involved, emotional pain. And it's totally natural for us not to want to go there. And yet, if that's something that we need to do for ourselves, then you have to do it. You have to take that step and, you have to muster that courage and go into that pain, because the only way to deal with it is to deal with it. Maybe part of our legitimate suffering is confronting people who have mistreated us, maybe family members, or somebody else. Establishing boundaries when our learned tendency has been to be silent. So that's just part of the legitimate suffering process. Shortly after I left the church and I was going through my local library looking for materials about trying to figure out how Mormonism had affected me psychologically, I came across some recorded lectures by Dr. Nathaniel Brandon, who is an American psychologist who pioneered the study of self-esteem. And he did this like 40 plus years ago. Started out looking at people in the military, you know, what makes a confident person in the military context. And he has published a number of books on self-esteem, and one of his books, The Six Pillars of Self-Esteem, for me is one of the five most influential books that came into my life. And from that book and from his recorded lectures on self-esteem, Dr. Brandon formulated that self-esteem, to trust your mind and to know that one is worthy of happiness, is the essence of self-esteem. And yet, Mormonism conditions people to betray their mind, and as a Latter-day Saint, you're only worthy of happiness if you are completely obedient. And I'm going to get into that in greater depth just in a moment. More specifically, self-esteem is a feeling of being worthy and deserving. The reputation that we acquire with ourselves over time, particularly with our mind. confidence in our ability to think correctly and in our judgments, confidence in our ability to cope with the basic challenges of life, confidence in our right to be happy and successful, however we define success for ourselves, a feeling of being entitled to assert our needs and wants, develop our values, and enjoy the fruits of our labor. Healthy self-esteem is based on the following practices: living consciously, self-acceptance, self-responsibility, self-assertiveness, living purposefully, and personal integrity. Living consciously. When we live consciously, we do not imagine that our feelings are an infallible guide to truth. And how applicable is that to the Mormon paradigm? Living consciously involves allowing ourselves to become aware, to magnify the fundamental characteristic of ourself, which is to be aware. What do we allow ourselves to become aware of? Repressed emotions, our personality. You know, one of the things that I just kind of organically stumbled onto in my own healing process was this intensity of my personality. Because as a Latter-day Saint, I was milquetoast. You know, I was a mama's boy. I was nice. Thank you. The price of nice. You can always be nice, but you can never be real, you know, when you're a Latter-day Saint, or rarely real. So, whatever your personality is, go into it. Embrace it. Open yourself to it. You might be just a naturally happy, exuberant, creative, very expressive person. And Mormonism, and I'm saying this a lot to the women, because of course in Mormonism, women are to be demure and self-sacrificing and conservative. And so if your natural personality is not that, but you have to be that as an LDS woman, then that's going to create that inner conflict. And we're aware of the fact that so many LDS women in particular suffer from depression. And that's part of the reason they're just not allowed to be themselves. They're not allowed to experience, be aware of their natural personality. Intellectual ability. That's a huge one. Again, particularly for women in the church. With its emphasis on mother, wife and mother in Zion and other things are secondary. To become more aware of desires, ambitions, sexuality, etc. Having a mind that is active rather than passive. Very important part of living consciously. Taking pleasure in our intelligence and intellectual abilities. Shortly after I left the church, there was a woman in my ward who left as well too, collapse of a marriage. She had a couple of teenage kids. She just knew, she had known, she told me since she was a girl, that, you know, she could get an advanced degree. And so there she was in, I guess, approaching 50, and finally gave herself permission to do that. But she had sensed that about herself all along because she was a very intelligent woman. Being in the moment without losing the wider context, seeking out facts rather than avoiding them, discerning between facts, interpretations, and emotions, noticing and confronting impulses to avoid or deny painful or threatening realities, knowing where we are in relation to achieving our desired goals and projects. I'm just going to quickly go through. This is the longest list of any of the six practices. But these are important points. Being concerned that our behavior is in alignment with our values and purposes. Searching for feedback from our environment so as to adjust our course when necessary. Persevering in the attempt to understand in spite of difficulties. Being receptive to new knowledge and willing to change old beliefs and assumptions. Being willing to see and correct mistakes. Seeking always to expand awareness and being committed to learn and grow. A concern to understand the world around us. And of course, as a Latter-day Saint, your world is just really a small village. And when you leave Mormonism, you begin this exodus across this vast continent of yourself, this undiscovered country. And off you go. Yeah. And it's a fascinating journey. A concern to, right, 16. A concern to know not only our external reality, but also our internal reality, thought patterns, feelings, aspirations, motives, etc., so as not to be a stranger or a mystery to ourselves. After I sent a letter, the letter to my bishop, telling him to remove my name from the church's records, he contacted me and said, well, you have to meet with me and the stake president. So I went to the local chapel. It was a short meeting. Door opened, and I went. There was the two men. Stake president had my letter in hand. We sat down after, you know, a few sort of niceties. The stake president went over basically the process of resigning from the church. And then he held up my letter and he said, why do you want to leave the church? And I just sat there for a couple of seconds of silence, and the words flooded into my mind, which then I articulated to him, if I don't leave the church, I will never know my true self. And the evidence of my personal experience in the last 14 years is such a powerful testimony of the truthfulness of that revelation. Of course, he had a look on his face like he couldn't understand. Exactly. 17. A concern to be aware of the beliefs and values that govern our behavior and their roots, so as not to mindlessly, unconsciously, live according to the beliefs and values of other people. And that's part of this individuation process, because of course, for all of us as kids, we just sucked up the beliefs and values of our parents, by and large. And as we gained more experience, and hopefully got a little bit of experience outside of the LDS world, you know, our opinions, our perspectives started to shift and change. And so we started to psychologically separate, to individuate, which we needed to do. Next slide. Practice of self-acceptance. Big one, right? For Latter-day Saints. Self-acceptance is the refusal to be in an adversarial relationship to oneself, to non-judgmentally regard ourselves just as we are and how we used to be. So that is self-acceptance. We just, no matter what I have done in my life, no matter the people who I have affected positively or negatively, no matter the opportunities that I have pursued or not pursued, no matter the amount of time that I spent in the LDS church or not, all of that is a part of who I am, who you are up to this point, and I fully, completely, and non-judgmentally accept that. And there's great power in that level, if you will, or that quality of self-acceptance. No condemnation. And this is why, is it coming up in the next point? It's coming up in the next point. Self-acceptance involves understanding that everyone acts according to their level of awareness. So when we watch the news about Saddam Hussein and the stuff that's going on in Iraq, those people who are blowing themselves up, having been psychologically conditioned by an extremist part of the Islamic religion to do so, but they are doing so even more fundamentally than that because they're operating on a certain level of awareness. There's psychological conditioning obviously going on, but they're just acting according to their level of awareness. Now, if they wanted to improve, if they wanted to be better people, then it would involve them shifting to basically a higher awareness about themselves, maybe starting to question, well, why the legitimacy of the idea of blowing yourself up because there's virgins in the afterlife, that kind of thing. It's as true for them as it is for us. That is a universal principle. Mentally beating up on ourselves, i.e. feeling guilty, does not make better people. A desire to change one's behavior does. And what causes us to want to change? It's when the pain and discomfort of our current situation becomes greater than what we perceive will be the pain and discomfort involved in changing. So the person who's a crack addict, who finally, or an alcoholic who finally bottoms out. Maybe they've fallen off the wagon 100 times, but they finally have that last crisis where they just finally get it, that the pain involved with getting over my addiction is going to be less than the pain that I'm in. Guilt is an unproductive emotion. When I think of the hours that I spent as a young Latter-day Saint, I have cassette recordings that I made when I was a teenager lying there in bed, telling myself how awful I felt about myself. I hated myself by the time I was 12 years old. That was to a very significant extent, the result of Mormon psychological indoctrination. Maybe you can relate in your own life, in your own experience, guilt, this useless, unproductive emotion of guilt. It accomplishes nothing. It wastes time and energy. Why? Because no one was ever made good by being told that they were bad. We change for the better when we want to change. We change for the better when that spark at the core of us says enough is enough of our current situation, of our status quo. We must change, and so we do. Self-acceptance involves letting go of negative judgments of ourselves, our thoughts and behaviors, the things that we have not done or achieved so far in life, how many years we spent in Mormonism, that's the point I raised before. Accepting, this is right out of Six Pillars of Self-Esteem by Dr. Brandon. Accepting compassionate interest does not encourage undesired behavior. Rather, it reduces the likelihood of it reoccurring. Okay, next slide. Self-responsibility. Perceiving oneself as a victim is a psychological obstacle to becoming more empowered. And is one of the huge challenges for mental health professionals when they're dealing with victims of abuse. Because the programming that's gone into their psyche over a period of time, and that might be from early childhood, has been one of victimization. That's been their experience. And so quite logically, they conclude that I'm a victim. But being a victim doesn't work in this world. We have to be empowered. There is that force at the core of us that is pushing us to become more powerful. And you might consider it a spiritual force or an evolutionary force, but it's there. It's there. And so making this transition from perceiving oneself as a victim to becoming more empowered, for a lot of people with experience in the LDS Church, that is a major part of their healing process. Taking responsibility for our happiness is empowering. No one owes us the fulfillment of our wishes. Not our spouse, not our parents, not our kids or our employer. If there is an aspect of our personal lives that isn't as we would like it to be, we're not making enough money, we were passed over for a promotion, there's a lot of conflict in our personal relationship, then the ultimate responsibility to initiate a change lies with us. Each of us is responsible for the achievement of our desires, our choices and actions, our behavior. I talked with a guy last night at the back table there. He's a defender in the Utah judicial system, and he works with people who have committed serious crimes. And he said, almost universally, there is this incredibly deeply entrenched denial. They just psychologically cannot get to the place where they fully will confess to themselves, I did this and my actions hurt that person or these people in those ways. And my own opinion about the judicial system is those type of people should never be let out of prison until they reach that point. And that applies as much to the kid who takes a candy bar as to a serial murderer. So that's, I got off on a little tangent there. Because why let them back out on the street if there's this core underlying denial that's not going to psychologically get them in a place where they're going to take responsibility for their behavior. That doesn't make any sense to me. Self-responsibility involves the level of awareness that we bring to our relationships and work, how we prioritize our time. How many people felt stressed out in terms of always having to, always feeling the need, really the anxious need to be busy as a Latter-day Saint? You know, that it just that mental lash all the time. Stirring from one end of the meeting house to the other, to the library to get your, you know, and then there's the meeting afterwards, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Just like, when I think back on that, it's just, one of my assignments when I was flying aerial surveys, we got a contract paid for by the Canadian government to spend 2 winters in the Caribbean. Just flying around taking vertical photography of the islands, had a lot of spare time. And if I wasn't flying, I was eating and just sitting by the pool and reading. Because there was no local LDS branch on the island. There was, you know, so I couldn't attend. And yet coming up against that psychological shove and pressure to be busy. You must be busy. You must be busy. And I have to tell you this story. The last church meeting that I was ever in was the Sunday or the Saturday, conference session. So visiting, I think it was a 70. And there's the Saturday evening session, right? And then the big session the following day. And I got in my car, drove to the Surrey Stake Center, arrived late, about 10 minutes late. The center section was open. The front, of course, the pews were filled and chairs were open at the back. So I came in late and walking across the gym floor, of course, in my shoes. So there's like clack, 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 clack. And people are turning around and looking and giving me the judgmental look of, you know, if you were a truly faithful saint, you would have been here at least 10 minutes ago and in your seat. But anyway, sat down and they had finished with the announcements, the opening hymn and the prayer, and they were sort of into the introduction of this 70. And just as he started to get up from his seat and approach the podium, the thought, literally, it was like words came into my mind, you don't need to be here anymore. And I got up. I had only been in my seat, you know, maybe all of about 2 or 3 minutes. And I got up and I left. And of course, the looks, you know, even more piercing, right? How can you possibly, this is a general authority, he's just about to speak to you. And went out into the parking lot and sat in my car and just this anxiety was just welling up inside me. And I asked myself, what do I do now? And the thought came into my mind, it doesn't matter. And I was like, what? And so I started up my engine and the car engine and so, well, where should I drive to now? You know, I'm here at the Stake Center. I'm supposed to be here. Where do I go now? And the thought came into my mind, it doesn't matter. And so I pulled out of the parking lot and just drove in that direction for I don't know, a few kilometers, and then I decided to turn right and went off in that direction for another few kilometers. And the whole, I was confronting this psychological result of years of this LDS in conditioning that I had to be busy and I had to be in a certain place at a certain time. And it just didn't matter. Not on that evening. And I have spent a lot of time in the last 14 years, just not really doing a whole lot in my spare time other than things that I wanted to do. Okay, self-responsibility. We are responsible for the quality of our communications. When we're in a relationship, we feel that the other person doesn't understand us. We're responsible for expressing our feelings to the best of our ability to express where we're coming from to the other individual, our boss or whoever it might be. No one's a mind reader. We're responsible for our personal happiness. Deciding which values will govern our behavior. You know, on the RFM board, it's fairly common to see a thread from someone who's just left the church. Well, you know, what values, what morals and values should I use? What set should I use to govern my behavior by? And it is up to the individual. That's that whole psychological maturation process. And how do we go about that? Well, you just experience life. You know, you go out and you try something. And and then you sit with the consequences of it. And obviously we have to exercise wisdom. You know, I'm not going to go off and start smoking meth. Again, why not? Because I've talked with people who the innate desire is not in me, but I know from an intellectual perspective that, you know, smoking meth is just not a good thing to do. But that's an important part of that individuation psychological maturation process, to develop our own values. And what I find extraordinary is for people who have left the church in terms of, and they, you know, can be atheists or agnostics or subscribe to some sort of a spiritual tradition, but so very often their values are just so much more functional and healthy and higher than the values of a lot of Latter-day Saints. And that's an interesting reality to be aware of. And self-responsibility, we are responsible for improving our self-esteem and the quality of our life. And not too many more, just three more slides. Okay, self-assertiveness means standing up for ourselves, to be authentic in word and deed, to treat ourselves with respect. To treat ourselves with respect. It means honoring our wants, needs, and values and seeking appropriate forms of their expression. Self-assertiveness involves understanding that our lives do not belong to other people, and the cult of the family is such a significant part of the Mormon church and the Mormon experience, where what the collective wants for you, what the collective believes, what the group, what the community thinks you should be doing with your life as a woman, what you should be doing as a 19-year-old young man, what you should be doing as a 45-year-old single person. And it's just so important for us to live our lives fully by our own mind and judgments, because that's how we develop the reputation with ourselves that we can trust ourselves. How many Latter-day Saints do you know or have heard of that need to go running to the bishop to check, to find out what, you know, color the Lord wants me to paint my kitchen? That's an example. That's a true example. We must develop a reputation with ourselves, with our mind, that we can fully trust our judgments. Self-assertiveness involves understanding that our lives do not belong to other people and that we do not exist to live up to their expectations. It involves unleashing our personality, which ties in with the comment that I said before, intellectual abilities, talents, just so many aspects of what you are, what each one of us is. Next slide. Living purposefully. To live purposefully is to use our powers to achieve our goals. A power of our intellect, our physical power, the power of our personality, the power of our sensitivity. Something that I learned after leaving Mormonism is I'm actually quite a sensitive person. My mind is quite sensitive. And so that was a personal reality that I needed to embrace in myself. And you're going to have something unique about yourself, that a unique power and powers that you need to just fully embrace in order to live purposefully. We have the right to establish goals for ourselves based on what we think and feel is right and good for ourselves. Part of that process of expressing ourselves fully as an individual. Whether anyone else approves of them or not, likes them or not, it truly doesn't matter. And you know, how many times have we heard at conferences where, you know, people say, you know, my wife gave me the final notice, basically, that that she's going to leave me simply because I've acted with integrity to myself, or it might be the husband, you know, who's leaving with the kids. Living purposefully also involves taking responsibility for formulating our goals and purposes, identifying the actions required to achieve them, monitoring our behavior to check that it is in alignment with our objectives, and paying attention to outcomes. And last slide. The last practice of self-esteem is personal integrity, which I've talked about a fair bit. Integrity is the integration of ideals, convictions, standards, beliefs, and behavior. Acting with integrity to what we deem to be right for ourselves is the key to being happy and at peace, regardless of what is happening in the world external to us. Because ultimately, we cannot base our self-esteem on anything external to ourselves. We can't base it on our membership in the church, because the church is changing, and so that's being threatened in the lives of a lot of Latter-day Saints. We can't base it on our marital status, because, you know, our spouse might announce one day that they're out of the relationship, they're going to leave, or a boyfriend, girlfriend, partnership, whatever it might be. We can't base it on our employment situation. Global economics, people being laid off, a former bishop of mine, 30 years, senior executive, Union Carbide, and got the notice. And psychologically, he had never contemplated that he would be one of those who would be caught up in a downsizing or change of operations, but it happened to him. So we cannot base our self-esteem on our employment or our academic credentials. We can't base it on our physical appearance. That might change. It might be in a car accident or something, and something might happen to us. We can't base it on our money, our possessions, natural disaster, or you know, something happens to a market overseas, and all our 401, what do you call them here in the States, your 401k? Your retirement plan, you know, maybe poof, down 10,000 or 10% overnight, because an overnight market, something catastrophic has happened over there. So we cannot base our self-esteem on those. When you think about it, you know, it comes down to yourself. And once you reach that place psychologically, where your self-esteem just isn't based on anything external, it is incredibly empowering, because you move into a place really of infinite possibilities, where, you know, you can do really just about anything that you want to, particularly in this society, as fortunate as we are. Acting with integrity to the truth, including our personal truth, involves paying a price, which is sometimes high. To do so takes courage. It takes sometimes quite a bit of courage, because there are unpleasant, life-changing consequences involved. And so it comes down to a choice. And that's my presentation. Thank you. Yeah, a little bit warm in here, isn't it? Yeah, any questions or comments? How much time? I guess we're a little bit over time, but yeah. I can, yeah. I'll make it available to you. Sure. Okay, yeah, absolutely. Okay, thanks. Yes. Okay, great. Super, appreciate that. Yeah.